Beyond presents Spoilers for The Tragedy of Cleopatra by Samuel Daniel, Part 2. Today we're looking at the last two acts of the play in detail. Following are some introductory notes intercut with a rough mix of our recording of the play, produced at the White Bear Theatre as part of our 2023 Revel season. There will be a better final cut, which will follow this release. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Unless you're listening to this in the future, in which case you don't have to wait, you can just go and hunt and find it now. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners won't enjoy. If it ain't for you, move on. If you're still listening, let's enter Spoilerland.
Spoilers, there's something nasty in the woodshed.
Maybe some wood. So, the first three acts have set the scene. Cleo planning, Caesar planning, the two meeting, and now we step out to see how the plan is going. There are two scenes in Act 4, one with servants behaving badly and a return to Cleopatra, before the play closes with some epic messenger action. This half of the play runs longer than the first, only slightly, because it's just heavier. I mean, it's a much darker half with, and this is content warning time here, the death of children and the death of our lead discussed at length. So do be warned. It's not cheerful stuff from now on. Also, just a quick reminder that this recording is of the earliest version of the play, not the later version, which tweaks the action in a number of ways that I won't go into detail about here, or at least not much. Act 4, Scene 1. Enter Seleucus and Rhodon. We've met Seleucus before. He got slapped, possibly, by Cleo in Act 3, but Rhodon is new. They are both repenting some life choices, and the play really leans into the doom now. There's a lot of the dooms. Both Seleucus and Rhodon have done a bad thing. They are here to compare notes.
Never, friend Rhodon, in a better hour could I have met thee e'en now I do. Having affliction in the greatest power upon my soul, and none to tell it to, for 'tis some ease our sorrows to reveal, if they to whom we shall impart our woes seem but to feel a part of what we feel, and meet us with a sigh but at a close.
And never, friend Seleucus, found'st thou one that better could bear such a part with thee, who by his own knows others' cares to moan, and can in like accord of grief agree. And therefore tell the pression of thy heart, tell to an ear prepared and tuned to care, and I will likewise unto thee impart as sad a tale as what thou shalt declare. So, shall we both our mournful plaints combine? I'll wail thy state, thou shalt pity mine.
We can be all sad face with each other together. A sad face shared is a sad face halved. Seleucus goes first. His betrayal is kind of simple. He was a trusted member of Cleopatra's court and he sold her secrets to Caesar. Unfortunately, Caesar thinks that informers are untrustworthy little shits. So he loathes Seleucus, and Seleucus has just realised that he's really, totally screwed.
Well then, thou knowest how I have lived in grace with Cleopatra, and esteemed in court as one of counsel and of chiefest place, and ever held my credit in that sort, till now in this confusion of our state, when, thinking to have used a mean to climb and fled the wretched, flown unto the great, following the fortune of the present time, am come to be cast down and ruined clean, and in the course of mine own plot undone. For having all the secrets of the queen revealed to Caesar, to have favour won, my treachery is quitted with disgrace, my falsehood loathed, and not without great reason. For though good for him, yet princes in this case do hate the traitor, though they love the treason. For how could he imagine I would be faithful to him, being false unto mine own, and false to such a bounteous queen as she that hath me raised and made mine honour known? He saw 'twas not for zeal to him I bear, but for base fear, or mine own state to settle. Weakness is false, and faith in cowards rare. Fear finds out shifts, timidity is subtle. Therefore, scorned of him, scorned of mine own. Hateful to all that look into my state. Despised Seleucus now is only grown the mark of infamy that's pointed at.
It's an interesting question as to how sorry for Seleucus we should be. He did betray Cleo, but to be fair, he's a small cog, and what difference would his betrayal really make to Cleo's situation? His woes related, Rhodon says, "You call that a lament? Hold my beer."
"'Tis much, thou sayest, and oh, too much to feel. And I do grieve and do lament thy fall. But yet, all this which thou dost here reveal, compared with mine, will make thine seem but small. Although my fault be in the self-same kind, yet in degree far greater, far more hateful. Mine sprung of mischief, thine from feeble mind. I stained with blood, thou only but ungrateful."
Yeah, sure, our crimes are kinda the same, but my betrayal got somebody killed, so I'm a tad bit more damned than you. For Rhodon was given one of Cleo's children to look after. And here he quotes Cleopatra again, tempting us to treat this as more material for the actor playing Cleopatra to deliver. "Take him away, somewhere safe.
For unto me did Cleopatra give the best and dearest treasure of her blood. Lovely Cesario, whom she would should live free from the dangers wherein Egypt stood. And unto me, with him, this charge she gave. Here, Rhodon, take, convey from out this coast this precious gem, the chiefest that I have, the jewel of my soul I value most. Guide him to India. Lead him far from hence. Safeguard him, where secure he may remain, till better fortune call him back from thence, and Egypt's peace be reconciled again. For this is he that may our hopes bring back, the rising sun of our declining state. These be the hands that may restore Arrak and raise the broken ruins made of late. He may give limits to the boundless pride of fierce Octavius and abate his might. Great Julius' offspring, he may come to guide the empire of the world as his by right."
She's not just speaking of the child and his pedigree, she's looking at him too, seeing in him his father and the power that he wielded.
"Oh, how he seems the model of his sire. How I gaze my Caesar in his face. Such was his gait. So did his looks aspire. Such was his threatening brow. Such was his grace. High-shouldered, and his forehead even as high. And oh, if he had not been born so late, he might have ruled the world's great monarchy and now have been the champion of our state."
That progression of talking generally and then more specifically about someone moves to speaking directly to her son. And here the text leans into the dramatic irony and that which is torturing Rhodon. She tells her son that he'll be safe with Rhodon. Again and again and again.
"Then unto him, oh, my dear son," she says, "son of my youth, fly hence. Oh, fly, be gone. Reserve thyself, ordained for better days. For much thou hast to ground thy hopes upon. Leave me, thy woeful mother, to endure the fury of this tempest here alone, who cares not for herself, though so thou should be sure. Thou mayst revenge when others can but moan. Rhodon will see thee safe. Rhodon will guide thee and thy ways. Thou shalt not need fear. Rhodon, my faithful servant, will provide what shall be best for thee. Take thou no care. And oh, good Rhodon, look well to his youth. The ways are long, and dangers everywhere. I urge it not that I do doubt thy truth. Mothers will cast the worst, and always fear. The absent danger greater still appears. Less fears he who is near the thing he fears.
And here the knife twists in a different way, as Cleo predicts something going wrong, and then pulls back from the thought and predicts, perhaps, a glorious future.
And oh, I know not what presaging thought my spirit suggests of luckless bad event, but yet it may be 'tis but love doth dote, or idle shadows which my fears present. But yet the memory of mine own fate makes me fear his. And yet why should I fear? His fortune may recover better state, and he may come in pomp to govern here. But yet I doubt the genius of our race. By some malignant spirit comes overthrown, our blood must be extinct in my disgrace. Egypt must have no more kings of their own. Then let him stay. Let us fall together. Sith it is foredecreed that we must fall, yet who knows what may come? Let him go thither. What merchant in one vessel ventures all? Let us divide our stars. Go, go, my son. Let not the fate of Egypt find thee here. Try if so be thy destiny can shun the common rack of us by being there. But who is he found ever yet defence against the heavens or hid him anywhere?
Cleopatra's conflict from earlier in the scene of how to proceed as queen or mother flits her between sending him away or keeping him close.
Then what need I to send him thee, to send thee so far hence, to seek thy death that mayest as well die here? And here, die with thy mother. Die in rest, not travelling to what will come to thee. Why should we leave our blood unto the east, when Egypt may a tomb sufficient be? Oh, my divided soul, what should I do? Whereon shall now my resolution rest? What were I best resolved to yield unto, when both are bad? How shall I know the best? Stay. I may hap so work with Caesar now that he may yield him to restore thy right. Go. Caesar never will consent that thou, so near in blood, should be so great in might. Then take him, Rhodon. Go, my son. Farewell.
But it's too hard to part. She pulls him back.
But stay. There's something else that I would say, yet nothing now. But oh God, speed thee well, lest saying more the more may make me thee stay. Yet let me speak. It may be 'tis the last that ever I shall speak to thee, my son. Do mothers use to part in such post-haste? What? Must I end when I have scarce begun? Ah, no, dear heart. 'Tis no such slender twine wherewith the knot is tied twixt thee and the mine. That blood within thy veins came out of mine, parting from thee. I part from part of me. And therefore I must speak.
Yet what? Oh, son.
Here, Cleopatra runs out of words, and we return to Rodon's account of Cesario's words to his mother. He semi-relates, and his own betrayal is underlined.
Here more she would, where more she could not say. Sorrow rebounding back whence it begun, filled up the passage and quite stopped the way, when sweet Cesario, with a princely sprite, though comfortless himself, did comfort give, with mildest words persuading her to bear it. And as for him, she should not need to grieve. And I, with protestations of my part, sworn by that faith which sworn I did deceive, that I would use all care, all wit and art to see him safe. And so we took our leave.
But the story, of course, doesn't end there, because Caesar wants the child, and Rodon delivers him, telling a lie to sugar the pill.
Scarce had we travailed to our journey's end, when Caesar, having knowledge of our way, his agents after us with speed doth send to labour me, Cesario, to betray. Who, with rewards and promises so large, assailed me then that I grew soon content, and back to Rhodes did reconvey my charge, pretending that Octavius for him sent to make him king of Egypt presently.
The lie is quickly exposed, and Rodon relates Cesario's last words. In the revised B version of this text, this sequence is turned into a scene with Cesario talking to Rodon. I personally prefer this version, where Rodon has to enact the results of his betrayal. I will let this play out.
And thither come, seeing himself betrayed, and in the hands of death through treachery, wailing his state, thus to himself he said, "Lo, here, brought back by subtle train to death, betrayed by traitors' faith, or traitors rather. My fault, my blood, and mine offence, my birth for being son of such a mighty father. From India, whither sent by mother's care to be reserved from Egypt's common rack to Rhodes, so long the irons of the tyrants are. I am by Caesar's subtle reach brought back, here to be made the oblation of his fears. Who doubts the poor revenge these hands may do him, respecting neither blood, nor youth, nor years? Or how small safety can my death be to him? And is this all the good of being born great? Then wretched greatness, proud rich misery, pompous distress, glittering calamity. Is it for this the ambitious fathers sweat, to purchase blood and death for them and theirs? Is this the issue that their glories get, to leave a sure destruction to their heirs? Oh, how far better had it been for me, from low descent, derived of humble birth, to have eat the sweet sour bread of poverty, and drunk of kneeless stream in kneeless earth, under the covering of some quiet cottage, free from the wrath of heaven, secure in mind, untouched when sad events of prince's dotage confounds whatever mighty it doth find. And not to stood in their way, whose condition is to have all made dear and all thing plain, between them and the mark of their ambition, that nothing let the full sight of their reign, where nothing stands that stands not in submission, where greatness must all in itself contain. Kings will be alone, competitors must down. Near death he stands, that stands too near the crown. Such is my case. For Caesar will have all. My blood must seal the assurance of his state. Yet a weak state that blood assure him shall, whose wrongful shedding gods and men do hate. Injustice never scapes unpunished still. Though men revenge not, yet the heavens will. And though Augustus, that with bloody hand cuts off succession from another's race, mayst find the heavens thy vows so to withstand, that others may deprive thine in like case. When thou mayst see thy proud contentious bed, yielding thee none of thine that may inherit, subvert thy blood, place others in their stead. To pay this, thy injustice heard you merit. If it be true, as who can that deny, which sacred priests of Memphis do foresay, some of the offspring yet of Antony shall all the rule of this whole empire sway. And then, Augustus, what is it thou gainest by poor Antyllus' blood or this of mine? Nothing but this thy victory thou stainest, and pull'st the wrath of heaven on thee and thine. In vain doth man contend against the stars. From what he seeks to make, his wisdom mars. Yet in the meantime, we whom fates reserve the bloody sacrifices of ambition, we feel the smart whatever they deserve, and we endure the present time's condition. The justice of the heavens revenging thus doth only sacrifice itself, not us. Yet 'tis a pleasing comfort that doth ease affliction in so great extremity, to think their like destruction shall appease our ghosts who did procure our misery. But dead we are, uncertain what shall be, and living we are sure to feel the wrong. Our certain ruin we ourselves do see. They joy the while, we know not how long, but yet, Cesario, thou must die content, for men will moan, and God revenge the innocent.
Thus he complained, and thus thou hearest my shame.
Similar themes of duty, power, lineage, and facing death abound. And Seleucus asks, and how did your betrayal pan out? And Rhodon goes, yeah, I'm going to be executed shortly, aren't I?
But how hath Caesar now rewarded thee?
As he hath thee. And I expect the same as fell to Theodore to fall on me. For he, one of my coat, having betrayed the young Antyllus, son of Antony, and at his death of his neck conveyed a jewel, which, being asked, he did deny. Caesar occasion took to hang him straight. Such instruments with princes live not long. Although they need us, actors of deceit, yet still our sight seems to upbraid their wrong. And therefore we must needs this danger run, and in the net of our own guile be caught. We must not live to bray what we have done. For what is done must not appear their fault. But here comes Cleopatra, woeful queen, and our shame will not be that we should be seen.
And having conveniently queued up Cleopatra, they clear the stage. So Act 4, Scene 2, Cleopatra's last stand. As with the tragedy of Antony, she doesn't make it to the last act. Her death will, however, be related in Act 5. Again, as text you could give to the actor if you liked. Here we have a last set piece to end her time physically on the stage. Here we have Cleopatra, all about Eve fashion, surprised at her ability to persuade, even in her current reduced circumstances, to get people to do what she wants. We, again, might balk at this self-objectification, but it's a bit late in the play to expect anything different. And, well, that's the patriarchy for you.
What? Hath my face yet power to win a lover? Can this torn remnant serve to grace me so, that it can Caesar's secret plots discover, what he intends with me and mine to do? Why then, Poor beauty, thou hast done thy last and best good service thou could do unto me. For now, the time of death revealed thou hast, which in my life didst serve but to undo me. Here, Dolabella, far forsooth in love, writes how that Caesar means forthwith to send both me and mine, the heir of Rome, to prove, there his triumphant chariot to attend. I thank the man, both for his love and letter. The one comes fit to warn me thus before, but for the other, I must die his debtor. For Cleopatra now can love no more.
She won round Dolabella, if not Caesar, and bought herself some time. And now she uses that time to say a last farewell to Antony.
But having leave, I must go take my leave and last farewell of my dead Antony, whose dearly honoured tomb must here receive this sacrifice, the last before I die. Oh, sacred, ever memorable stone, thou hast without my tears within my flame received the oblation of the woefulest moan that ever yet from sad affliction came. And you, dear relics of my lord and love, the sweetest parcels of the faithfulest liver, oh, let no impious hand dare to remove you out from hence, but rest you here forever. Let Egypt now give peace unto you dead, that living gave you trouble and turmoil. Sleep quiet in this everlasting bed, in foreign land preferred before your soil. And oh, if that the spirits of men remain after their bodies and do never die, then hear thy ghost, thy captive spouse, complain and be attentive to her misery. But if that laborsome mortality found this sweet error only to confine the curious search of idle vanity, that would the depth of darkness undermine, or rather to give rest unto the thought of wretched man with the ever after coming joy of those conceived fields whereon we dote, to pacify the present world's annoy. If it be so, why speak I then to the air? But 'tis not so. My Antony doth hear. His ever-living ghost attends my prayer, and I do know his hovering sprite is near, and I will speak and pray and mourn to thee. Oh, pure immortal love that deigns to hear, I feel thou answerest my credulity with touch of comfort, finding none elsewhere.
Having wrestled with the question as to whether Antony's ghost is listening, he is, Cleopatra works through her current predicament. Can she really stay alive now? Really?
Thou knowest these hands entombed thee here of late, free and unforced, which now must servile be, reserved for bands to grace proud Caesar's state, who seeks in me to triumph over thee. Oh, if in life we could not severed be, shall death divide our bodies now asunder? Must thine in Egypt, mine in Italy, be kept the monuments of fortune's wonder? If any powers be there whereas thou art, sith our own country's gods betray our case, O work they may their gracious help impart to save thy woeful wife from such disgrace. Do not permit she should in triumph show the blush of her reproach, joined with thy shame. But rather, let that hateful tyrant know that thou and I had power to avoid the same. But what do I spend breath and idle wind in vain invoking a conceived aid? Why do I not myself occasion find to break the bounds wherein myself am stayed? Words are for them that can complain and live, whose melting hearts composed of baser frame can to their sorrows time and leisure give. But Cleopatra may not do the same.
And so she is resolved to follow Antony into death, and she expands upon this theme.
No, Antony, thy love requireth more. A lingering death with thee deserves no merit. I must myself force open wide a door to let out life and so unhouse my spirit. These hands must break the prison of my soul to come to thee, there to enjoy like state, as doth the long-pent solitary fowl that hath escaped her cage and found her mate. This sacrifice, to sacrifice my life, is that true incense that doth best beseem. These rites may serve a life-desiring wife who, doing them to have done enough, doth deem. My heart blood should the purple flowers have been, which here upon thy tomb to thee are offered. No smoke but dying breath should here be seen, and this it had been too, had I been suffered. But what have I save these bare hands to do it? And these weak fingers are not iron pointed. They cannot pierce the flesh being put unto it, and I of all else means am disappointed. But yet I must a way and means seek how to come unto thee whatsoe'er I do. Oh, death, art thou so hard to come by now that we must pray, entreat, and seek thee out? But I will find thee wheresoe'er thou lie, for who can stay a mind resolved to die? And now I go to work the effect indeed. I'll never send more words or sighs to thee. I'll bring my soul myself, and that with speed. Myself will bring my soul to Antony. Come, go, my maids. My fortune's soul attenders that minister to misery and sorrow. Your mistress unto you your freedom renders and quits you from all charge yet ere tomorrow.
I don't think those maids are literal, but you could people this scene if you wish. And, paean to death complete, she gets down to practical matters. She awaits the means of her death to arrive. Always frustrating to await a delivery. We tried to deliver your poison, but you were out.
And now, by this, I think the man I sent is near returned that brings me my dispatch. God grant his cunning sort to good event, and that his skill may well beguile my watch. So shall I shun disgrace, leave to be sorry, fly to my love, scape my foe, free my soul. So shall I act the last act of my glory, die like a queen, and rest without control.
And exit Cleopatra, physically for good. But she will speak via others later. And it's time for the chorus again, as we close Act 4. Two speakers in the recording, but the chorus isn't broken up beyond as stanzas. We start with the dance around What is Egypt? How did it all go so wrong?
Mysterious Egypt, wonder breeder. Strict religion, strange observer. State order, zeal, the best rule keeper. Fostering still in temperate fervour. Oh, how camest thou to lose so wholly all religion, law, and order, and thus become the most unholy of all lands that Nile's border?
How could confused disorder enter where stern law sat so severely?
How durst weak lust and riot venter, thy of justice looking nearly? Could not those means that made thee great be still the means to keep thy state?
Ah, no. The course of things requireth change and alteration ever. That same continuance man desireth, the inconstant world yieldeth never.
We,
in our councils,
must be blinded
and not see what doth import us. And oftentimes the thing least minded is the thing that most must hurt us. Yet they that have the stern in guiding...
'Tis their fault that should prevent it.
For oft they, seeing their country sliding, take their ease.
As though contented.
We imitate the greater powers. The prince's manners fashion ours.
So the country went wrong because the people followed the bad example of the rulers? All them vices begat more vices, and that made Egypt weak and ready for conquest by Caesar.
The example of their light regarding vulgar looseness much incenses. Vice uncontrolled grows wide, enlarging. King's small faults be great offences. And this hath set the window open unto license, lust, and riot.
This way confusion first found broken, whereby entered our disquiet.
Those laws that Zoroaster founded and Ptolemies observed hereby first came to be confounded.
Which our state so long preserved.
The wanton luxury of court did form the people of like sort.
For all, respecting private pleasure, universally consenting to abuse their time, their treasure, in their own delights contenting, and future dangers naught respecting, whereby...
Oh, how easy matter made this so general neglecting, confused weakness to disaster!
Caesar found the effect true tried in his easy entrance making, who, at the sight of arms, descried
all our people,
all forsaking for riot,
worse than war,
so sore had wasted all our strength before.
And the chorus hammers that point about restraint versus fun again.
And thus is Egypt servile rendered to the insolent destroyer, and all their sumptuous treasure tended, all her wealth that did betray her, which poison,
oh, if heavens be rightful,
may so far infect their senses that Egypt's pleasures so delightful may breed them the like offences.
And Romans learn our way of weakness.
Be instructed in our vices, that our spoils may spoil your greatness.
Overcome with our devices.
Fill full your hands, and carry home enough from us to ruin Rome.
Don't have fun, people, or you will become weak and be conquered. Anyway, exit chorus. On to Act 5. Scene 1 opens as an appetizer to the main event. Enter Dolabella and Titius. Titter ye not. Titius is the servant to Dolabella, who, as we have heard variously, is besotted with Cleo. Tell me everything. Like, did she like my news? Tell me everything.
Come, tell me, Titius, every circumstance, how Cleopatra did receive my news. Tell every look, each gesture, countenance, that she did in my letters reading news.
I shall, my lord, so far as I could note, or my conceit observe in any wise.
And so off he goes, all the deets. He picks up as we left off the last scene, which means that you could sort of let this scene run on from the last. If you wished, you could keep Cleo on stage and have Titius step back into that moment which he is relating. That's the clever, clever directorial flourish you might choose. Or not. So, she's in the midst of the funeral rites for Antony. She looks at the message and smiles. And of course, we know that this is playing into her hands. The irony meter should be going wild at this point.
It was a time when, as she having got leave to her dearest stead to sacrifice, and now was issuing out the monument with odours, incense, garlands in her hair, that when I approached as one from Caesar sent, and did her close thy message to understand, she turns her back, and with her takes me in, reads in thy lines thy struggle, unlooked for tale, and reads, and smiles, and stays, and doth begin again to read, then blushed, and then was pale, and having ended with a sigh, refolds thy letter up, and with a fixed eye, which steadfast her imagination holds, she mused a while, standing confusedly.
and here she speaks. And again, with this play, Cleo is in pretty much every scene, even when she isn't. She now tells the big lie that she will acquiesce to all of Caesar's wishes.
At length. Ah, friend. Save she. Tell thy lord how dear I hold his pitying of my case, that out of his sweet nature can afford a miserable woman so much grace. Tell him how much my heavy souled off grieve, merciless Caesar, should so deal with me. Pray him that he would all the counsel give that might divert him from such cruelty. As for my love, say Anthony have all. Say that my heart is gone into the grave with him in whom it rests and ever shall. I have it not myself, nor cannot have. Yet tell him he shall more command of me than any whosoever living can. He that so friendly shows himself to be a right kind Roman and a gentleman, although his nation fatal unto me, have had mine age a spoil, my youth a prey, yet his affection must accepted be, that favours one distressed in such decay. Ah, he was worthy then to have been loved of Cleopatra whilst her glory lasted, before she had declining fortune proved, or seen her honour racked, her flower blasted. Now there is nothing left but her disgrace, nothing but her affliction that can move. Tell Dolabella, one that in her case, poor soul, needs pity now than love, but shortly shall thy lord hear more from me. And, ending so her speech, no longer stayed, but hasted to the tomb of Anthony. And this was all she did and all she said.
So off she pops to the tomb to kill herself, though Dolabella hasn't twigged yet that is what is actually going on. He's more interested in relating his pity and admiration for her for quite a while, and resolving to try and convince Caesar to be merciful to her.
Oh, sweet, distressed lady, what hard heart could choose but pity thee and love thee too? Thy worthiness, the state wherein thou art, requireth both, and both I vow to do. Although ambition lets not Caesar see the wrong he doth thy majesty and sweetness, which makes him now exact so much of thee to add unto his pride, to grace his greatness. He knows thou canst no hurt procure us now, sith all thy strength is seized into our hands. No fear is that, but rather labours how he might show Rome so great a queen in bands, that our great ladies, envying thee so much, that stain them all and held them in such wonder, might joy to see thee and thy fortune such, thereby extolling him that brought thee under. But I will seek to state what I may. I am but one, yet one that Caesar loves, and oh, if now I could do more than pray, then shouldst you know how far affection moves. But what my power and prayer may prevail, I'll join them both to hinder thy disgrace. And even this present day, I will not fail to do my best with Caesar in this case.
Titius suggests that relations between Caesar and Cleopatra might go well. Look, she's sending a letter to Caesar while she goes to a tomb and with her maids and some guide. Nothing suspicious about any of that.
And, sir, even now herself hath letters sent. I met her messenger as I came hither with a dispatch as he to Caesar went, but knows not what imports her sending thither. Yet this he told, how Cleopatra late was come from sacrifice, how richly clad was served to dinner in most sumptuous state with all the bravest ornaments she had, how having dined, she writes and sends away him straight to Caesar, and commanded then all should depart the tomb, and none to stay, but her two maids and one poor countryman.
No alarm bells ring for Dolabella. He's sure that Cleopatra has sent for Caesar to turn his head like previous Romans.
Why, then I know. She sends to have audience now and means to experience what her state can do, to see if majesty will make him bow to what affliction could not move him to. And oh, if now she could but bring a view of that fresh beauty she in youth possessed, the argument wherewith she overthrew the wit of Julius Caesar and the rest, then happily Augustus might relent, whilst powerful love, far stronger than ambition, might work in him a mind to be content, to grant her asking in the best condition. But being as she is, yet doth she merit to be respected for what she hath been, the wonder of her kind, of rarest spirit, a glorious lady and a mighty queen, and now but by a little weakness fallen to do that which perhaps she was forced to do. Alas, a narrow pass is past recalling. Take away weakness and take women too. But now I go to be thy advocate. Sweet Cleopatra, now I'll use mine art. Thy presence will me greatly animate. Thy face will teach my tongue, thy love my heart.
And exuant with the irony meter going nuts. It's a clever scene, though tricky to get all of those ironies across. A lot of work needs to be done there to really make those land. Act 5, Scene 2, and enter messenger to the chorus. It's a bit of a shame that this message isn't addressed to Dolabella, and I did try that in rehearsal, but the chorus really is a distinctive character, and it just doesn't function in the same way, alas, because it would be a lot tidier in a way. Anyway, depressing messenger time! It's Act 5. Let's hear the tale of woe. The chorus naturally ask, what's with the woe?
Am I ordained the careful messenger, and sad news bringer of the strangest death, which self hand did upon itself infer, to free a captive soul from servile breath? Must I the lamentable wonder show, which all the world must grieve and marvel at? The rarest form of death in earth below that ever pity glory wondered at.
What news brings you? Can Egypt yet yield more of sorrow than it hath?
What can it add to the already overflowing store of sad affliction, matter yet more sad?
Have we not seen the worst of our calamity?
Is there behind yet something of distress, unseen,
unknown?
Tell of that greater misery there be, that we wail not that which is less.
Tell us whatso it be, and tell at first.
For sorrow ever longs to hear her worst. Well,
oblique messenger time, with the chorus being almost willfully thick in not twigging where the message is going.
The strangest thing relate I will, that ever eye of mortal man hath seen. I, as you know, even from my youth, have still attended on the person of the queen, and ever in all fortunes, good or ill, with her as one of chiefest trust have been. And now, in these so great extremities that ever could to majesty befall, I did my best in what I could devise, and left her not till now she left us all.
What?
Is she gone? Hath Caesar forced her so? Yea,
she is gone, and hath deceived him too.
What?
Fled to India
to go find her son?
No, not to India, but to find her son.
Why then there's hope she may her state recover.
Her state? Nay, rather honour and her lover.
Her lover?
Him she cannot have again.
Well, him she hath, with him she doth remain.
Why then she's dead?
Is so?
Why speaks not thou?
You guess aright, and I will tell you how.
The queen is gone. Oh, where? On her holidays? After that clarifying stichomythia, the messenger makes this epic bit of storytelling. Now, I'm a storyteller, so this is meat and drink to me. But again, you can hand Cleopatra her reported speech and semi-enact this sequence, or just let it run. It's the end of the play. The sunk cost fallacy means the audience isn't going to leave now.
When she perceived all hope was clean bereft her, that Caesar meant to send her straight away and saw no means of reconcilement left her. Work what she could, she could not work to stay. She calls to me, and she thus began.
Throat clearing complete, Cleo gives the orders for her death. Get me 2 aspics, stat!
O thou, whose trust hath ever been the same, and one in all my fortunes faithful man, alone content to attend disgrace and shame. Thou, whom the fearful ruin of my fall never deterred to leave calamity, as did those other smooth state pleasers all, who followed but my fortune and not me. 'Tis thou must do a service for thy queen, wherein thy faith and skill must do their best. Thy honest care and duty shall be seen, performing this more than in all the rest. For all what thou hast done may die with thee, although 'tis pity that such faith should die. But this shall evermore remembered be, a rare example to posterity. And look, how long as Cleopatra shall in after ages live in memory, so long shall thy clear fame endure with all. And therefore, thou must not my suit deny, nor contradict my will. For what I will, I am resolved, and this 'tis thou must do me. Go, find out with all thy art and skill 2 aspics, and convey them close unto me. I have a work to do with them in hand. Inquire not what, for thou shalt soon see what. If the heavens do not my designs withstand, but do thy charge, and let me shift with that.
The messenger obeys and relates how they got the parcel past the guards.
Being thus conjured by her to whom I had vowed my true perpetual service, forth I went, devising how my close attempt to shroud so that there might not no art my art prevent. And so, disguised in habit, as you see, having found out the thing for which I went, I soon returned again and brought with me the aspics in a basket closely pent, which I had filled with figs and leaves upon, and coming to the guard that kept upon the door, "What hast thou there?" they said, and looked thereon. Seeing the figs, they deemed of nothing more, but said they were the fairest they had seen. "Taste some," said I, "for they are good and pleasant." "No, no," said they, "go there, bear them to thy queen." Thinking me some poor man that bought a present.
Having got past the guards, the messenger sees the queen in full death glam mode.
Well, in I went, where brighter than the sun, glittering in all her pompous rich array, great Cleopatra sat, as if she had won Caesar and all the world beside this day. Even as she was when on thy crystal streams, O Cydnos, did she show what earth could show, when Asia all amazed in wonder deems, Venus from heaven was come on earth below. Even as she went at first to meet her love, so goes she now at last again to find him. But that first did her greatness only prove, this last her love that could not live behind him. Yet as she sat, the doubt of my good speed detracts much from the sweetness of her look. Cheer Mara care did then such passions breed that made her eye bewray the care she took. But she soon no sooner sees me in the place, but straight her sorrow-clouded brow she clears, lightning a smile from out a stormy face, which all her tempest-beaten senses cheers. Look, how a strayed, perplexed traveller, when chased by thieves, and even at point of taking, descrying suddenly some town not far, or some unlooked-for aid toward him making, cheers up his tired spirits, thrusts forth his strength to meet that good that comes in so good hour. Such was her joy. Perceiving now at length her honour was to escape so proud a power.
This is a vision of triumph, not defeat. And from description to action, the hunt amongst the figs for the aspics.
Forth from her seat she hastes to meet the present, and as one overjoyed she caught it straight, and with a smiling cheer in action pleasant, looking among the figs, finds the deceit, and seeing there the ugly venomous beast. Nothing dismayed, she stays and views it well. At length, the extremest of her passion ceased, when she began with words her joy to tell.
And we have the last speech to the snake, which is perhaps why it's best not actually to stage this literally. It might risk bathos there. I mean, it's a good speech, but saying it to what's probably a rubber snake, might be fine. Might be fine, wibbly wobbly rubber snake.
O rarest beast, saith she, that Afric breeds, how dearly welcome art thou unto me. The fairest creature that fair Nilus feeds, methinks I see in now beholding thee. What though the ever-erring world doth deem that angered nature framed thee but in spite? Little they know what they so light esteem that never learned the wonder of thy might. Better than death, death's office thou dischargest, that one with gentle touch can free our breath, and in a pleasing sleep our soul enlargest, making ourselves not privy to our death. If nature erred, oh then how happy error, thinking to make thee worst, she made thee best. Sith thou best freest us from our lives' worst terror, in sweetly bringing souls to quiet rest. When that inexorable monster death, that follows fortune, flies the poor distressed, tortures our bodies ere he takes our breath, and loads with pains the already weak oppressed. How oft have I begged, prayed, entreated him to take my life, and yet could never get him. And when he comes so ugly grim, that who is he, if he could choose, would let him. Therefore come, thou of wonders, wonder chief, that open canst with such an easy key the door of life. Come, gentle, cunning thief, that from ourselves so stealest ourselves away. Well did our priest discern something divine shadowed in thee, and therefore first they did offerings and worships due to thee assign, in whom they found such mysteries were hid. Comparing thy sweet motion to the sun, that movest without the instruments that move, and never waxing old but always one, dost sure thy strange divinity approve. And therefore, too, the rather unto thee, in zeal, I make the offering of my blood. Calamity confirming now in me a sure belief that piety makes good, which happy men neglect or hold ambiguous, and only the afflicted are religious. And here I sacrifice these arms to death, that lust late dedicated to delights, offering up for my last this last of breath, the complement of my love's dearest rites.
And yet at this final moment there is a hesitation, another moment of doubt, as with the sending away of her son. The dance between life and death is related at length.
With that, she bares her arm and offer makes to touch her death. Yet at the touch withdraws, and seeming more to speak, occasion takes, willing to die and willing too to pause. Look how a mother at her son's departing for some far voyage bent to get him fame doth entertain him with an idle parling, and still doth speak, and still speaks but the same. Now bids farewell, and now recalls him back, tells what was told, and bids again farewell, and yet again recalls. For still doth lack something that love would feign and cannot tell. Pleased he should go, yet cannot let him go. So she, although she knew there was no way but this, yet this she could not handle so, but she must show that life desired delay. Fain would she entertain the time as now, and now would fain that death would seize upon her, whilst I might see presented in her brow the doubtful combat tried twixt life and honour. Life, bringing legions of fresh hopes with her, armed with the proof of time which yields, we say, comfort and help to such as do refer all unto him and can admit delay. But honour, scoring life, lo forth leads he bright immortality in shining armour. Through the rays of whose clear glory she might see life's baseness, how much it might harm her. Besides, she saw whole armies of reproaches and base disgraces, furies fearful, sad, marching with life and shame that still encroaches upon her face in bloody colours clad, which representments, seeing worse than death, she deemed to yield to life, and therefore chose to render all to honour, heart, and breath. And that with speed, lest that her inward foes, false flesh and blood, joining with life and hope, should mutiny against her resolution.
She remonstrates with herself, as though her body has sided with Caesar.
And to the end, she would not give them scope. She presently proceeds to the execution, and sharply blaming of her rebel powers. False flesh, saith she, and what dost thou conspire with Caesar too, as thou wert none of ours, to work my shame and hinder my desire? Wilt thou retain in closure of thy veins that enemy base life to let my good? No. No, there is a greater power constrained than can be counterchecked with fearful blood. For to the mind that's great, nothing seems great. And seeing death to be the last of woes and life-lasting disgrace which I shall get, what do I lose that have but life to lose?
And so she allows the snake to do its work and says her last farewells to Antony, and last taunt to Caesar.
This having said, strengthened in her own heart, and union of herself senses in one, charging together she performs that part that hath so great a part of glory won. And so she receives the deadly poisoning touch, that touch that tried the gold of her love pure and hath confirmed her honour to be such as must a wonder to all worlds endure. Now not a yielding shrink or touch of fear consented to bewray least sense of pain, but still in one same sweet unaltered cheer her honour did her dying thoughts retain. Well, now this work is done, saith she. Here ends this act of life that part of fate's assigned me. What glory or disgrace here this world lends, both have I had, and both I leave behind me. And now, O earth, the theatre where I have acted this, witness I die unforced. Witness my soul parts free to Antony. And now, proud tyrant Caesar. Do thy worst. This said, she stays and makes a sudden pause, as 'twere to feel whether the poison wrought, or rather else the working might be cause that made her stay, as likewise may be thought. For in that instance I might well perceive the drowsy humour in her falling brow, and how each power, each part oppressed, did leave their former office and did senseless grow. Look how a new plucked branch against the sun declines his fading leaves in fable sort. So her disjoined jointures, as undone, let fall her weak dissolved limbs support. Yet lo, that face, the wonder of her life, retains in death a grace that graces death. Colour so lively, cheer so lovely rife, that none would think such beauty could want breath. And in that cheer, the impression of a smile did seem to show she scorned death and Caesar, as glorying that she could them both beguile, and telling death how much her death did please her.
She fades away, a painless death. Charmion tidies up Cleopatra's diadem, last handmaid standing, as Eris is dead already.
Wonder it was to see how soon she went. Oh, she went with such a will, and did so haste it, that sure I think she did her pain prevent, foregoing pain, or staying not to taste it. And senseless, in her sinking down, she rised the diadem which on her head she wore, which Charmion, poor weak, feeble maid, espies, and haste to right it as it was before. For Eris now was dead, and Charmion too, even at the point, for both would imitate their mistress' glory, striving like to do. But Charmion would this in exceed her mate, for she would have this honour to be last that should adorn that head that must be seen to wear a crown in death that life held fast, that all the world might know she died a queen.
As Charmion does this last act, the messengers from Caesar arrive, because Caesar isn't an idiot, and he knew pretty much straight away what her last message meant, but it's too late.
And as she stood, setting it fitly on,
lo,
in rush Caesar's messengers in haste, thinking to have prevented what was done. But yet they came too late, for all was past. For there they found stretched on a bed of gold, dead Cleopatra, and that proudly dead, in all the rich attire procure she could, and dying Charmion trimming of her head, and Eris at her feet, dead in like case.
Charmion, is this well done? Said one of them.
Yea, well, said she, and her that from the race of so great kings descends doth best become, and with that word yields to her faithful breath to pass the assurance of her love with death.
The chorus helps clear up any doubts as to how clever Caesar is.
But how knew Caesar of her close intent?
By letters, which before to him she sent. For when she had procured this means to die, she writes and earnestly entreats she might be buried in one tomb with Antony, whereby then Caesar guessed all went not right, and forthwith sends. Yet, ere the message came, she was dispatched. He crossed in his intent. Her providence had ordered so the same that she was sure none should her plot prevent.
And the chorus get to sermonise the end of the play. We've seen the terrible fate that came to Egypt due to excess. Can we bow to Caesar's might? mostly told through the image of the Nile's waters, and how the land survives a flood, and how the excess of Egypt will be the inheritance of Rome, and how they too will suffer from the same issue.
Then thus we have beheld the accomplishment of woes, the fall of ruin, and the worst of ills, and seen all hope expelled, that ever sweet repose shall repossess the land that desolations fills, and where ambition spills with uncontrolled hand all the issue of all those that so long rule have held, to make us no more us, but clean confound us thus.
And canst Nilus, thou, father of floods, endure that yellow Tiber should with sandy streams rule thee? Wilt thou be pleased to bow to him, those feet so pure, whose unknown head we hold a power divine to be? Thou that didst ever see thy free banks uncontrolled live under thine own care, wilt thou bear it now? And now wilt yield thy streams a prey to other realms.
Draw back thy water's flow to thy concealed head. Rocks, strangle up thy wave. Stop cataracts thy fall, and turn thy courses so that sandy deserts dead, the world of dust that craves to swallow thee up all, may drink so much as shall revive from vasty graves a living green which, spread, far flourishing, may grow on that wide face of death, where nothing now draws breath.
Fattened some people there, even as thou us hast done, with plenty's wanton shore, and feeble luxury, and them as us prepare, fit for the day of moan, respected not before. Leave levelled Egypt dry, a barren prey to lie, wasted for evermore, of plenty's yielding none, to recompense the care of victor's greedy lust, and bring forth naught but dust.
And so, O leave to be, Sith thou art what thou art, let not our race possess the inheritance of shame, the sea of sin that we have left them for their part, the yoke of whose distress must still upbraid our blame, telling from whom it came, our weight of wantonness lies heavy on their heart, who never more shall see the glory of that worth they left who brought us forth.
O thou, all-seeing light, high president of heaven,
you magistrates of stars, of that eternal court,
of providence and right, are these the bounds ye have given?
The untranspassable bars that limit pride so short.
Is greatness of this sort that greatness mars?
And racks itself self-driven on rocks of her own might.
Doth order so, disorders overthrow.
And fini. As the question of order versus disorder, vice versus sin, fun versus control are handed up to gods to judge. Now, having performed this play with an audience in basically an unchanged static state, I can say that it works. I mean, people do down neoclassical tragedy all the time, and it is bloody hard work for both cast and audience, but it does work. I've rarely seen such focused attention in a room for a show. That's not to say that it's for everyone, or that it should be performed without cuts or adaptation. I think there's a host of ways to perform this play, and I have about three different productions in my head. A heavily cut-down storytelling type version, a cut-down but fairly standard production, and a full bells and whistles version. And that's just this version of the play. When you add the later drafts and the tragedy of Antony into the mix, you have got a host of material to play with as you choose. That's a challenge. And that's it from these spoilers episodes. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the text, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your thoughts, or not. If you'd like more on this play, there are exploring sessions on YouTube, as well as vast amounts on the play The Tragedy of Antony, which is of use when getting into this sequel. Links in the show description. The full cast audio adaptation edit of this will follow soon, so keep an ear out. The recording used throughout this episode is a live mix of the performed play. It's a rough mix and focuses on the text as writ, so the final release will be cleaner and a more entertaining listen. In the version used throughout this recording, the cast was as follows. Pamela Flanagan as Cleopatra, Kit Maguire as Seleucus, Karim Cromfley as Rodon, Valentina Vinci, Dolabella, Sojourner Hazelwood Connell, Titius, Alex Capilla, Messenger, Emma Kemp as Chorus Number 1, and Rule Fox, who produced the music, and Red as Chorus 2. The producer was myself, Robert Crichton. This spoilers episode was hosted and produced by myself, Robert Crichton, for the Beyond podcast. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, etc. at Beyond Shakes. Visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org, or you can support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Goodbye.